You don't have to do this.
Yes, I do.
But you suck.
You're welcome, sweetheart. All right, Mike, let's get this over with. Sudden death. Whoever wins this point wins.
Okay.
And that's how it's done.
When did you stop sucking?
I never sucked. I just didn't want you to know how good I was.
Why?
I don't know.
Well, this is so great. Now we can enter into doubles tournaments.
That's why.
Objective Secure Podcast. My name's Mike.
Hi, I'm Emma.
This is episode 34. That's how it's done. We're going to be talking a little bit more about life of a TO and some of the stuff that goes on in the background that maybe you don't think about as a player. Maybe you don't hear about it from your local TOs. It's something that we talked about at length, kind of at random.
It's a totally random conversation.
on one of our live streams. So we thought it might be a good opportunity to share some of that in a more... easy to find format that our listeners and potentially future TOs might be interested in hearing about some of the stuff that goes through our minds when we start planning events and share some of our experiences and some of the pitfalls and things that we've learned. There have been many and
many pitfalls. I'm not sure we've learned anything.
Many learnings, I would like to think, but this is our fourth year.
Mm-hmm. We've just done our fourth Masters, so yeah, we're into our fourth year running.
Yeah, so the first blood is just around the corner for us for 2019, mm-hmm. which is the fourth time running, which is kind of what kicked us off in terms of the annual schedule. It did the first year.
Our first event was Masters.
First event was Masters, but we didn't sort of plan on it being the sequence of events that it was, I think, when we first talked about Masters. So... yeah, we're going to give you some insights into some of that sort of stuff and, talk about what goes on behind the scenes that you may or may not see, and particularly with CanCon just gone as well.
Mm-hmm.
Here in Australia. They've just, today actually, at the time of recording, have just finished CanCon. We have to say congratulations to Eric Lathouris from Queensland for taking out CanCon 2019. Well done, mate.
That's 40K.
That is for Warhammer 40,000, I should say, yes. It's the one that I've been following over the last 3 days through Down Under Pairings and Down Under Network.
Mm-hmm.
So be sure to head over and check out the live streams on Twitch. Yeah, I think you can still view them today after they've been live. So that's if you want to watch some of the top games, particularly the last game where Eric played Lee, which was essentially 200 models a side with two different armies. It was a very high model count. They had the guys from Chapter Tactics helping on the stream doing some commentary as well, which was great to hear. So, very, very much worth checking out those games that they were streamed over the eight 40K games over mm-hmm. CanCon. So, head over to Down Under Network on Twitch. But before we get into the topic, what do we have to talk about?
Well, we've just had Australia Day.
Yes, we have.
So, happy Australia Day to the Australian people listening. I believe the same day was Indian Republic Day. So, happy Indian Republic to any Indian people listening.
Yeah, did not know that.
That's all I've got.
Fair enough. Well, in terms of hobby stuff, apart from CanCon, we actually did have a couple of WA boys go over to CanCon.
Mm.
Rob Horton and Aaron Thompson that I'm aware of.
Yep.
I don't know if any of the other boys took the trip over, and if you did, let us know so we can look up your results and mention you in the next episode.
Mm-hmm.
We also had ex-WA player Matt Clegg, who moved to Victoria at the end of last year.
He's still a WA player.
He was at CanCon this year as well. I have to give props to Rob, though. Rob finished 47th out of 150.
Nice.
He was the highest finisher from the WA group that I'm aware of. Again, if I'm wrong, let us know. Happy to correct that.
Having said that, you did look at all the names in Down Under pairings, and generally we recognise most of the WA people.
Yeah, look, I mean, and I'm fortunate that I recognise a lot of the East Coast guys as well. So, you know, the big Victorian names and the big Queensland names were there. The Aussie Battlers from New South Wales were there. Godhammer Gaming, Hammer House, you know, all of the regular East Coast clubs and teams were represented, basically. So it was a good turnout for the guys who were running CanCon 40K, so Chris and Chris. No major hurdles that I heard of. You know, obviously every TO has some altercations they deal with over 3 days and 150 players. I'm sure there were more than a couple.
It's exciting to have 150 players.
Yeah, it was. It's not the biggest 40K event in Australia, but it's in terms of its format, it's the biggest.
Mm. 3 days.
Well, even things like ARC in Victoria, which regularly and have for 2019 cracked 200 players, it's a two-day event with much smaller points limits. Mm. So this is a full-blown 2,000-point ITC major, you know, endorsed by the ITC circuit.
Is it 6 games or 9 games?
Eight.
8 games, right, of course. So I'm totally wrong.
Three and two.
Yeah.
With 150 players.
See, I had the threes and I had the twos.
Well, it meant they actually got one winner. So yeah. Eric was the only player to go 8-0.
Oh, nice.
In the final round, it'd be interesting to see what would happen had he lost that final game, because then no one, he was the only player to go undefeated. Yeah. But the opponent he was playing wasn't undefeated when he got there, because everyone else had dropped, all the top players had dropped at least one game earlier in the event.
Mm-hmm.
So most of them lost at round 4 from the looks of the results. I could be wrong, but just looking at what I could see.
It'd be interesting to see what the mission was for round 4 that...
I'm more interested to know how much drinking went on after game 3, because that was the end of day 1.
Oh, yeah, okay. And then, so coming and that was, in very hungover.
That was Australia Day.
Yeah.
And then coming in on...
Interesting choice to hold it on Australia Day.
Well, they've always held it over...
It's a long weekend.
Yeah, they've always held it over that for the 3 days. So, yeah, it was interesting to watch a bunch of them drop that same round, and they were all the top players that dropped it in the same round. So
they were all out drinking together the
night
before,
quite possibly. It's pure speculation, but...
It is, and we would hate for that to be...
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, no, it's...
I mean it in good
yeah,
fun.
Good humour, right? Yeah.
That's the word I was looking for.
The only upset, I think, for everyone, Jeremy Martino, I believe, finished second. Again, I could be wrong. I only scanned the results today.
Probably should have checked that, shouldn't
Jeremy
you?
Finished first the preceding 2 years. So this would have given him his hat trick. And he missed it by losing
much.
One game. Which, I believe was day two. So, but still an amazing result for Jeremy, particularly with the army he took. The top three lists were, and I again, Best Coast Pairings is showing them all as sisters of battle, because none of them have selected the right armies. But I believe, I know Eric was playing Tyranids with Genesteel Occult. Mm-hmm. I believe Jeremy was running Death Watch with Imperial Knights. And I believe... Astra Militarum, and then from what I understand, third place I believe is Hayden Warduck again from Queensland.
Oh.
I might be wrong with Hayden, because looking at the results, there were about 4 players tied for third, so I think it counted back on strength of schedule. So Liam Hackett, also from Queensland, was up there. I think Matt Morisoli from Victoria finished in the top 10. Like, there were some a lot of the prolific 40K player names that I'm used to recognising at the high-end tournaments were in the sort of the top 10, top 15 out of the 150. Mm-hmm. So that was really cool to see. And full props to Eric, because the list was one that I don't think many people even considered as an option. And then he's rocked up with over 180 models and, yeah, won the event 8-for-8 without dropping a game.
Hmm.
And Tyranids aren't generally considered to be that sort of top-tier army. And he was running Genesteel Occult. Admittedly, it was only a Supreme Command with a handful of HQs and the Genestealers. But it was an interesting list put together.
Back to what we've talked about before, that it's not necessarily about playing with what's considered to be a strong list. It's about putting together a list and knowing how to use it to its best advantage.
Oh, absolutely.
And then, you know, playing in every conceivable situation so that you know that list inside out, how it works, and then...
Eric's been playing Tyranids for years, and on top of that, his, I suppose, what he's done is take something that plays really well to the ITC mission format.
Yeah.
And the final round was really interesting to watch because he was playing another list that literally won games by playing the mission format rather than the opponent.
Yeah.
And he was able to outplay his opponent and with some really good positioning and some critical, selection in targets and charges, he was able to pull out, I think it was 22 to 15 raw victory points at the end of the game. So it was a pretty decent win. I mean, it wasn't a huge win by ITC standards, but it was a firm win. It wasn't a 1 or 2 point scrape.
But again, it's things that we've talked about, which is knowing how to use strategy to your best advantage.
Yeah.
And rather than just going in and, just going hard and trying to shoot everything in front of you, knowing the different strategies that you can implement and, using the army to the best possible advantage that you can.
We're also very fortunate. Aaron Thompson sent me a whole host of images while he's been away, particularly when the army's on parade.
That's interesting because I haven't seen any on the Facebook page.
No, not yet. He sent them to me and there's a lot of them. He took them while I was on Armies on Parade.
Yeah.
So I've got a bunch of them that I'll share. Hopefully before you're listening to this, I might have to get on that tomorrow before I publish the podcast. Mm. There's plenty of them.
Thank you, Aaron.
Yes, thank you very much, Aaron. And there's plenty of them if you search CanCon 2019 on Facebook, you can find links to it. You can find it on Best Coast Pairings if you're interested in seeing the lists. Most of them, I was about 30% not there, including the top list, sadly.
Interesting.
But you can go to downunderpairings.com and all the lists are in there. I know the guys were trying to keep it in both locations because the Australian in general tends to use Down Under Pairings, whereas obviously for ITC and the Americans, it sits on Best Coast Pairings.
That's right.
So, we've also had the announcements, it must have been this morning or yesterday, for the pre-orders for the Gene Stealer Cult Codex and a whole host of new models for them, which is, for 40K players, quite exciting. Myself included, I've got a Gene Stealer Cult army sat out there waiting for the day that the codex drops. So.
And it is going to be waiting a little bit longer because there is a giant Titan that still needs painting.
Well, we're going to move on to the Titan in just a second because I am very excited about the Gene Stealer Cult Codex because some of the new models look amazing. Very quickly, and I'd love to get you, I haven't shown you the two models. I probably have to while we're on the air. There were two models that have been previewed now for release very shortly, both of them female, and they've caused some really weird controversies as far as I'm concerned. So I was interested to see what you thought of both of them. So there's a new model about to be released in conjunction with a new Black Library novel. And it's on the Warhammer community site at the moment, and the name of it escapes me. Severina Rain, I think it is. From one of the new Black Library novels. Ignoring its fine cast and all the rest of it, I've got it up on screen now. What do you does it say to you female straight away?
No, it doesn't. I suppose it looks like an Eastern European pirate.
So for those of you not following us, it's worth going and like I say, if you Google female commissar, it's pretty close to the top of them. In Google, but if you head to the Warhammer community page a couple of days ago, they had it there. For me, what I really like about this is it's not overtly like your traditional sort of boobs out styling that a lot of sort of 80s and 90s female miniatures in particular had.
Yeah.
The modern style armor is just actually reminiscent of what happens in real world war when women go into combat. It's, they don't have boob plate. The arms are more slender. The legs are a bit more slender, but it's actually the jawline and the face that says to me female more than anything. But it's not overtly feminine, is it?
No.
So that's now bear in mind, they announced that and then they've released...
I'm not sure how I feel about that, by the way.
What?
The fact that it's not overtly feminine.
Well, that's kind of what I was going to ask because the next miniature they've previewed is... I'll see if I can find it. It's the new Gene Stealer Cult Magus. And it's very feminine. I'm just going to find it here on the screen. And again, be very interested to see what you think about this one because it's a far closer cry to the boob plate, I suppose, of old. It's got a much more feminine figure in terms of it's quite narrow-waisted, quite wide-hipped. It's wearing knee-high from the looks of it, heeled boots. Mm-hmm. Again, you've got quite pronounced cheekbones and a really narrow chin and half boob armor, half dress.
It's very hard. He's got the laptop like
going to get
200 meters away from me.
It's not 200 meters away from me. It's not
at
my
least a meter.
Not my fault you're blind.
I've got my glasses on and everything.
I'll get a better picture for her so she can...
You can cut this bit out if you don't have to listen to us scrolling.
So there you go. If you head to the Warhammer community page, it's under the pre-ordered preview Gene Stella Colts. Now, for me, this is very clearly feminine. Bearing in mind she is bald.
Yes, she is.
And she does have the ridges on her head because she's an alien. Mm-hmm. But this one is really overtly female compared to the Commissar.
Still very... very well, like, they're very much covered.
Yeah, so there's no...
there's no boobs out.
I mean, she's got bare
like
shoulders,
that.
Bare arms.
She's got bare...
shoulders and upper
arms. But, you know, literally all of her chest is covered.
Yeah, so it's like a half corset with, like, a dress or
a
something underneath it.
Underneath.
Yeah. So what's been really interesting from fans is that a bunch of them have been saying the female Commissar doesn't look female enough. Mm. And there's been a lot of push over the years to try and get a more realistic approach to women in armor in miniatures, because that sort of highly stylized sexual stuff can be, a controversial issue for people. Mm. And then you've got this model, which, like I say, has a very hourglass style figure, has the knee-high boots.
She actually reminds me more of the women from Black Panther.
Yeah, that's actually a really good comparison.
So...
actually, yeah, now you say that, having just watched Black Panther a couple of days ago.
Oh, I haven't seen it for quite some time, so I can't remember the name of the character.
The Royal Guard, the nine of them, I think they are, with their spears. You're actually... yeah, now you say that, I can't... you take the hood off her and...
and the alien creases. But,
but yeah, no, they were all bald, though. They all... yeah. And you just swap the Gene Stella Magus staff for a spear, and she's basically one of the guards from... Black Panther, now you say that. Mm. So,
and I guess...
so this model, the point I was getting to, this particular model, I haven't seen anything negative about.
Okay.
This one has been, yep, that looks amazing. And I love this model as well.
Yep, me too.
The Commissar has...
her, dagger.
Yeah, it's a cool... it's just a really nice... it feels like it's a natural pose. It's not, super stylized. It's... got purpose. She looks powerful. She looks dangerous. Mm-hmm. It's a really nice sculpt. Mm-hmm. Whereas the Commissar, despite having all of those things, because it's not as female, has seen some negativity in the community. Mm. And despite the fact she looks exactly like the artwork, like she's, it's a really sort of interesting one for me to see, because the community is quite polarized on her compared to the Gene Stealer. And I was just wondering, like, yeah, what are your thoughts on that?
Personally, I don't like her. The reason that I don't, and I have spoken about this before, is that I think that we're getting to a point, and it's difficult because I do describe myself as a feminist, and what, you know, people have different definitions of that, and my definition of a feminist is somebody who wants equality for both genders.
So I'm just going to very quickly put the book up on the screen so you can compare the artwork. This is the Severina Rain novel Honor Bound by Rachel Harrison, which is another anomaly, a female
woman.
Author. So the artwork on the cover, again, doesn't look super feminine, but again, I can tell it's a woman. Mm-hmm. The model is almost identical.
Actually, I would say the model looks more feminine than the front cover.
Yeah, I'd probably agree with that.
Yeah.
The fact you can't see her hair in this miniature, whether because the artwork looks like she's got some sort of bun or bob at the back of her hair.
Yeah, which makes sense.
Which, obviously, this miniature, if you twist it 30 degrees left or right and you see that, then that will obviously change the tone of the miniature as well. Mm. But it's been really polarizing on the online forums as to whether people like this miniature or not, because some say it looks like a man.
Yeah, so what I was going to say before is that, I did say feminism is, for me, equality for both genders. I should say equality for all genders. But I guess what I feel is that we're getting to a point where it's not okay for women to actually have an attractive figure, or for women to look sexy or to want to look sexy, you know, because And I think that we've flipped too far the other way. And are we going back to a point where actually you can't show ankles and, you know, and elbows and things like that because it's too risque? And I don't want us to move to that point. So I actually think that women have a female figure. That should be okay.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's the difference between the two models, is that with the one that I think looks like an Eastern European pirate.
So the Commissar Severina.
She doesn't have, you can't see that feminine figure.
Yeah.
And while I understand that this is some, that we're aiming to be close to what, you know, a real life soldier would look like, and that real life armor isn't supposed to be showing off a female figure or showing off a man's figure for that matter. What I think is that this, could you please stop swiveling the woman in the G-string around on the screen well, while is, I try and concentrate?
This was my third.
Let me get
miniature.
my damn point out. We've got to remember that this is actually a game.
Yeah.
And this isn't realistic. And that, you know, so when, if there are women who want to play with women, who want to play with female characters, do they want them actually to represent a female figure?
Or
and
do
having,
they...
having a female character who looks like a man does not feel like it's hitting it for me.
Okay. So this is, I'm going to jump back. This is a fifth edition 40K release. This is circa 2011 would be my guess.
Mm-hmm.
This is Lelith Hesperax.
Yep.
She's a Dark Elder Drakari witch cult succubus. She is the succubus. She's no shoes, but she's thigh-high armor, G-string, and her top is not armored. It's more like a crop top, I suppose, is the best way to describe it.
It actually looks quite a bit like what female fire performers wear.
So she's actually a gladiator in the stories and in the in the game.
Mm-hmm.
There's a little bit of armor across her right shoulder. She's got the gloves on. She's got big barbed swords or daggers or whatever you want to call them.
And long flowing hair.
Long flowing hair. And hooks and chains and stuff. Her jawline's nice and narrow. Again, very hourglass figure, despite her pose in this particular case, because it's quite a wide stance. And yeah, she's muscled.
Yeah. Okay, so looking at this picture, can you bring up the... sorry, I can't remember the name of the...
Severina?
No, not her, the other one.
The Magus.
Mm-hmm. Bring up Magus again. Now, if you look at Magus, her legs are painted black. Right.
Which yeah. So she's got the black knee high boots. Yeah.
She's got black knee high boots, and then above that, she's painted black as well.
Yeah. She's got some sort of bodysuit on.
Now that's the way it's painted.
Yes.
And the way it's depicted. So if you look at that one and imagine the difference it would make if those black leggings were actually painted skin tone.
Yeah. Okay.
All of a sudden, it very much changes that image. Now go back to the chick in the G-string, and imagine that she's got leggings painted underneath instead of flesh. And all of a sudden we go from something that's, you know, MA rated to something that's actually quite socially acceptable.
Well, if you wind back far enough, and I don't know if I'll actually be able to find a picture of this while we're chatting, but there was a model release back in third edition, again for the Drakari, because the Drakari seems like they went through, when they were first released, they went through this weird bondage kind of moniker. The model was called Cruella the Vile. Cruella the Vile, sorry. Now, when the miniature was released, she came out. It's a terrible miniature, so I'm not going to deny that. It's absolutely awful. She came out with red armor again up to the mid thigh, and then a black bodysuit with what can only be described as Borat's mankini over the top.
Mm-hmm.
How many people do you think painted that ma'am that black bodysuit into skin tone?
And this is exactly what we're seeing.
So literally the second example in Google is the naked version. And
that's pretty nasty.
Yeah. Now, I should, without being too completely risque, this particular artwork hasn't painted all the detail on because they did go a little bit far in the sculpting side of things for this particular miniature. Mm. So in terms of the Drakari range, they have come a long way. But, I mean, I'm just scrolling down here and I reckon... 2 out of 3 examples of this particular miniature were painted naked. And all of the ones that aren't painted naked are the official paint job.
Ones. Yeah.
So,
but that's what I mean. Like, you got to remember
this is late 90s.
These models come grey plastic.
Yeah, well, in this case, metal, but
well, they come grey or silver of some description. So it really does come down to how each individual paints them, and that can make a huge difference.
Yep, absolutely. It's like I say, it was just an interesting one that I saw, particularly with Severina, that it had been so, like, I saw it and went, I want that miniature. Yeah. It's really cool. I really like it.
Mm-hmm.
And the amount of people I've seen that have said, oh no, it looks too much like a man. And from men and women, not just other male gamers, made me go, oh, I looked at it and went, like, particularly the jawline is what gives it away for me.
Yes. Yeah, look, definitely you can see that it's a woman, but from first glance, no, it's not a feminine sculpt at all.
I think a lot of it's to do with that huge big armor plate that they've put on her to match the artwork. She's got that big steel...
She does, yeah. The steel corset type thing.
Well, it's not a corset. It's just a big flat piece of metal, because what it essentially does is, because the between the belt and the
the
long
coat...
She
just looks like a pirate. Don't you think?
I think it's the curved sword and the...
It's the swashbuckling little swishy flicky thing at the bottom as well.
the cape and the tassel, or the long coat, sorry, and the tassels.
Yeah.
I think the fact there's
the shoulder pads. No, it's all pirate.
She's meant to be like that
pirate.
No, she's not meant to be pirate.
She's got men's boots on, and I mean, not that obviously you wouldn't go to war in 6-inch stilettos, but
no. But if I show you the male version of that, so the Imperial Commissar is the uniforms are all very similar. I mean, that's an older version of it, but it's got the same tassels, the same trench coat, the same...
He's a very ugly man.
That's one of the old metal ones. The new plastic ones are much nicer sculpt, and I'll see if I can get that on the screen for you as well. But just looking at some of the older examples, they're all dressed.
Yeah.
Like, they've done the right thing and put her in the same uniform, essentially. Like, they've given her the same style boots, the same knees, the same chest armor, the same sort of...
It's just a slightly more feminine head.
So that's the current plastic one, I believe. So, again, you can see the boots are basically the same. They haven't got the knee pad.
He doesn't look quite as piratey. Oh, he's still got the pirate-esque, but she's really rocking the pirate.
I think the biggest thing, though, in terms of difference is she's got that big steel plate on her torso, where all the others have got the buttons and the filigree and whatnot. That's probably the biggest thing that stands out. Although, if you look at the fine cast Lord Commissar, he does have that steel plate, although it's less pronounced because they've cut it in half with a ribbon or a sash or whatever you want to call it. But so good job on them for keeping the same styling that all the other current range has, but just doesn't quite do it for you as a female officer.
It really doesn't, no.
Okay, interesting. Not saying it's right or wrong. I just, like I say, I wanted to get your take on it, and I wanted it without rehearsal so I could show them to you now and get your honest opinion.
Yeah, we should probably rehearse it next time.
Nah, it's much more interesting this way. Okay, well, we'll talk my Titan, because you mentioned that earlier, in the ending of the episode. But for now, we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to be back to talk some of the things that go into getting an event off the ground.
We're back.
And we're going to talk more TO stuff today. We have done an episode in the past called Life of a TO, which we answered some questions and some other bits and pieces. There'll be a link in the show notes if you're interested in going and checking out the old episode.
Really wish I'd listened to that.
We did it a while ago now. It's in
Listen
the...
to both and see if our answers have changed.
We've definitely run events since that episode, but I'll find a link to that and put it in the show notes on the website if you're interested in going back and listening to it. So, like I said in the introduction, which was a bit long-winded, but that's nothing new for us, we got talking on our live Facebook that we do every second Wednesday off the back of a question around organising events, and it kind of snowballed partly into a soapbox rant and partly into us sharing some of the challenges that you face when organising events.
Mm-hmm.
And someone suggested turning it into a podcast. So here we are. Whether we get it all done in this episode or not is another matter entirely. And obviously your circumstances may vary based on your own situation and location in this wide world of ours, and some of the laws and regulations that surround what you can and cannot do with different venues, but we can share some of our experiences and some of the planning processes that go into things, and then, you know, hopefully cover it in one or two episodes. And then, yeah, we were happy to take any further questions, and we can add those to future episodes as well.
Mm-hmm.
So let's start off with probably the most important thing is date.
Mm.
And date's kind of tied into venue, which is also tied into your other resources.
So it's a bit like, if you imagine that you've got a ball of wool that a cat's been playing with, and you've got to try and unravel it.
Yeah.
That's a bit what this episode's going to be like.
Yeah, because intrinsically it's all intertwined.
Everything's linked, yeah.
Yeah. So one of the most common ones is, how do you pick a date?
Mm.
Some of the things that we have to think about with dates, ignoring the venue availability or other things like that,
yeah.
You have to look for, obviously, public holidays, mm-hmm. Or national holidays, or depending on where you are in the world, they can be called a few different things, but basically bank holidays and
yeah.
stuff where people aren't working, because a lot of the time we see events run on those weekends.
So there's a couple of things.
But there's
that
a double-edged sword there.
Yeah, exactly. So we didn't realise for one of our events, and we ran an event on Father's Day.
Yep.
Now,
that was a screw up.
It was not one of our best decisions, partly because you're obviously a dad and mm-hmm. we didn't get to spend Father's Day with our children.
No.
So, you know, that's not brilliant. But, with 95% of our attendees being men.
Yeah.
And as much as there's this stereotype around gamers being, you know, antisocial guys who can't hold a conversation and have never had a girlfriend and, you know, live in their parents' basement.
No, I reckon the vast majority of our gaming yeah. community is either attached or married with kids.
Yeah, I'd say at least 50% have children, which means they're then having to decide whether or not they take time away from their kids on Father's Day to
yeah.
spend it. But also, if you said 80% of our attendees have a dad or a
yeah.
father-in-law, you know, you're kind of going, well, we're a bit stuffed here.
Yeah.
So that year we did have, I think that was our lowest attendance for Masters.
Yeah. It didn't quite hit 60. I think it was 56 or something
yeah.
like that. Yeah.
So, you know, you got to look at things like that. Also, we've spoken about the fact that we're rearranging Southern Hemisphere Open this year because it would fall on the grand final for football.
Yeah. For the Australian Football League,
yeah,
AFL, and that, well, that doesn't sound like much to our international
I know,
viewers.
I think just about everyone has a sporting,
yeah.
you know,
it'd be like
a sport that stops the nation.
It'd literally be like putting it on, you know, the Super Bowl weekend, although LVO did do that the weekend I was there, or putting it on, you know, the World Cup, the FIFA World Cup
yeah.
or something similar, you know, the final for the Baseball World Series, those sorts of things.
Probably not the best choice.
No.
Really.
The other thing to consider with those long weekends is people go away.
Exactly. Yep.
Again, if they have family, it's not uncommon, particularly here in Australia, for us to, okay, Friday afternoon, we finish work, we get in the car and we drive and we go somewhere, or we get on a plane, we fly to Bali, or, you know, we go away for a few days and you come back
yeah.
on the Monday afternoon and you go to work Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
So that can also affect attendances.
Yep.
So the long weekend seems like a great idea, but it's a commitment that you have to sort of hope that your players, you know, will prioritise.
Yeah.
Because there are going to be other factors.
And it's not just your players who are prioritising.
No, it's the
families. Families as well.
Yeah.
And as much as a lot of our players and certainly your personal friends joke about getting a leave pass from your wife, we know when we talk about that, it's very sort of tongue-in-cheek. But it is actually taking people away from their family in order to come and
yeah.
play for a day or for a weekend, or, you know, we spoke about CanCon, which was 3 days. That's a really big commitment.
Yeah. And, you know, particularly if you've got young kids in the house and, you know, it depends on the support network that your partner might have. There's a whole bunch of factors that can go into that decision rather than going, hey, I want to go and do this event. And the partner just saying, yeah, sure, go for it.
Mm.
The level of consideration has to be there as well. And obviously that's a personal thing,
yeah.
but it's something that we have to consider when we plan events.
Other things that we consider is, of course, the other events that are happening
yeah,
around us.
There's no point in us, you know, conflicting with other events of the same game system if we can help it?
No, we're so as well as taking into consideration the clubs and stores that run events around us, so we're really aware that there's a finite pool of players, and particularly tournament players.
And there's only so many times you're willing to leave your family.
Well, also, if you've got... We had it when we were doing show last year. We were running a 40K event Saturday, Sunday and Monday, and one of the local stores wanted to run a 40K event on the Saturday as well. And you're kind of going, really? Like, is that a good idea?
Yeah, and someone mentioned it to them and they changed it straight away. But, yeah, I definitely think if you don't take into account where those gamers are going to be potentially at other events, avoiding any conflicts is always going to be the best thing. Even if it's week after week, that's still not great. We like to try and leave
at least a couple of weeks difference
if we can help it. Sometimes it's unavoidable.
It is, yeah. But also trying to think about the crossover events as well. So we try and not run an event on the same weekend that any gaming event is running.
Yeah.
Except, of course, when we do run Southern Hemisphere Open and we whack them all on the same weekend and then make people choose. But
yeah,
we're aware that a lot of gamers do cross between gaming systems.
Yeah.
And so if we're running a 40K event while, you know, somebody else is running a bolt action event,
yeah,
there's a lot of players who play both and we don't want to make them choose. So, being aware of what else is happening in your community is a really good start.
I think that's just being community conscious, mm-hmm. And not just about the game system you play, but the fact your players will almost inevitably play at least one other system. There's very few players, I think, who would just go, no, I only play this game.
Yeah.
Most of them will dabble in other things, and if they're playing tournaments and competitively, the chances are that they're going to go to multiple events.
Yep.
So I think being community-minded in that regard so that you're working with other TOs as opposed to against them, is a really positive thing to have in the community. The other thing to think about with those dates is school, so uni exams, school holidays.
And so right now you're probably thinking, well, that's it. There's no weekends left.
No.
Which we do often get to that point.
Sometimes you just have to draw the line and go, look, we know it's going to impact X, Y, or Z. That's just the way it's going to be.
And we have got that this year for Southern Hemisphere Open. We do know that this is the June long weekend is leading into uni exams.
Yeah. And Masters for us, when we run it in November, inevitably runs. Hits in the same sort of period here in Australia for the run-up to the uni exams and end-of-year stuff for tertiary qualifications and TAFE and things.
And it's just at the very tail end of the Year 12 ATAR exams as well. So, you know, it is really difficult finding a date, and all of this stuff does come into play when we are trying to book our calendar.
So having said all that, once you actually find a date you like, you've still got to make sure you've got a venue.
Yeah. We actually go the other way because the venue that we do try and use for a number of different reasons, although they have put the price up on us and we still haven't quite forgiven them, they book out really quickly.
Yeah.
So we tend to go, tell us what dates you've got available and we'll see what we can make work.
Yeah. I know that obviously if you're running events in a store, if you've got a local gaming store that's happy to let you run events in there, obviously that's a much more flexible venue for you because...
Yes and no, because quite often they've got other events that are absolutely running as well.
But if you know that the venue's already there and they've already got the terrain and the boards and all that other sort of stuff, then, you know, moving it a week here and there to accommodate them doing a Magic Open pre-release or something else is more tenable than having to work around any public
weddings
hall or...
and things like... Yeah.
Yeah. So the...
Then for us, we do actually have to make sure that fits in with different weddings that I have booked.
Yeah, and that's the other thing is obviously making it sort of...
work for the TO.
Yeah, because, I mean, for the last 2 years we've run show, it's been the weekend immediately following our son's birthday.
Yeah.
Which has been hard on him.
Mm-hmm.
Because the lead up to that event means that...
We are not nice people.
No, sadly. And we're taking steps to change that to make it easier on us and on our family, which is another one of the many reasons why we've moved it for 2019. Mm. So you know your family situation also has to play a part in it. Have you got a wedding to go to that weekend? Is your wife pregnant in her third trimester? I probably advise
not
doing it.
That. Yeah.
You know, is she scheduled to go in for like a cesarean or something that weekend? Probably don't do it then.
Yeah, no.
Christenings, first birthdays, anniversaries, any of those sorts of, you know, real life factors have to also be taken into consideration when you start looking at dates. And as Emma said, by this stage, you should be shaking your head going, cool, so...
2023.
Yeah.
Where's the weekend in?
And that's where you just have to start prioritizing which of those you can live with conflicting with and which of them you can't. What's the deal breaker for the date?
Yeah.
And if you go, oh, that's okay, we'll do it on the 25th of December.
Yeah, that's probably
a deal breaker. The Easter long weekend for us in Australia is a four-day long weekend. Friday, mm-hmm. Saturday, Sunday, Monday seems like a great option for a tournament.
No.
Probably not.
No.
There was an event many years gone by that used to run over that weekend. But the attendance obviously isn't super awesome over that weekend because, again, people have commitments that revolve around family and potentially religion. And
yeah, we do have quite a few public holidays in Australia. And some of them are more highly regarded than others.
Yeah.
So, for example, that's why I was a little bit surprised that CanCon runs on Australia Day, because Australia Day is, you know, that's the day when everyone gets together and they have backyard parties in a pool that they made in the back of a ute with chairs that they made out of empty beer cans.
Pickup truck for those US listeners, pickup truck, not a ute.
And then, you know, everyone goes to the fireworks and the sky show, and it sort of has all of these traditions that go with Australia Day.
But I wonder whether part of that, at least for us, is to do with West Australia, because I know that a lot of the councils around the country have stopped their Australia Day fireworks and things. So,
I don't know. But I know I've been seeing a lot of photos of different states still having fireworks on Australia Day. I know that one council
in WA
has...
You'd think in Canberra, where they host CanCon... capital of Australia, you'd think that they'd do something there, but all accounts, they didn't.
Yeah.
So, and to be honest, if I got this option to go to CanCon, like Australia Day wouldn't mean anything to me going.
No.
When I say that, I mean the day wouldn't mean anything to me to miss out on
going to the Sky Show.
Yeah. I'd quite happily skip that.
Anzac Day is obviously another one here that is quite a...
So that's the Australian New Zealand...
Army Corps Memorial Day.
Yeah, from
testing your memories.
I've got to get the dates right. It's basically to commemorate our men and women who served during World War I and World War II, National Day of Remembrance, I suppose, for our armed forces.
Day, but anyway,
it's commemorating the Australian New Zealand Armed Forces.
Darling, here's what I'm thinking. If you're not 100% sure, just skip over it. Okay, because otherwise you're talking.
I know it in my head, but it's late.
Mm. So anyway, Anzac Day, one of the things that we have talked about before is whether or not it's a good idea to host a tournament on Anzac Day.
I know there are plenty of the Australian Defence Force guys who do.
Mm.
There's the ADF Gamers League over in, I believe they're in Queensland. I could be wrong. Queensland, New South Wales. They hold an event over Anzac Day, or they have traditionally. And I know that over the years we have seen them irregularly in Perth over that day, because that day is the 25th of April, and it's an interesting date because obviously it's not always a weekend or a Friday or a Monday.
No.
It moves around a bit, so we have seen one day tournaments run on like
on a
Tuesday.
Wednesday. And it's something that we've talked about, but because neither of us are, you know, have worked in the Defence Force of it, I guess we have tried to be sensitive to that. And so we haven't run events on Anzac Day, but we have spoken about it and talked about whether or not it's a good idea in a nice way. I guess because a lot of our attendees are ex-servicemen.
Yeah.
I don't know that we've got any ex-service women, but currently serving in the Defence Forces.
Several. Yeah.
So we thought it might be a nice way to kind of get people together, but obviously those are the days when... days generally start with marches and things like that. So another thing to think about is if you are doing it on a public holiday, is there something that would mean that people can't attend, such as Anzac Day marches not finishing until 10 a.m.
Yeah.
And our events normally start at 8. So I've totally lost my train of thought now.
Yeah, so the date is... It seems like something really easy, but when you actually start digging around into it, it's something that you do have to put a bit of thought into, because the date will make or break an event for a lot of people based on their own personal situation. So picking a weekend where there's no extracurricular stuff happening, where there's no, you know, football finals or, you know, just a general everyday weekend is often the best bet, because you're not going to get everyone, because someone will inevitably have a birthday or a party or something happening. You know, engagement parties or bucks nights or any of those things.
We get what a party is.
But you'll get, what, 80, 85% of your potential attendees available, typically speaking, which means that you've got a better chance of getting the event.
I think one of the things that I've noticed that some of the new TOs do is they throw too much out to ask for feedback.
Yeah.
And it's something that we generally don't do. So we never throw it out and say, what date's going to work for you for this event? And the reason that we don't do that is because it's always going to not work for someone.
Yeah.
And so if we've thrown it out there and five people who are regular attendees can't come on Saturday the 5th, they're then going to be upset that we've chosen a date that they can't come. So what we have to do is we look at it from our point of view and we go, based on the dates that this particular hall is available, based on the significant events that are happening in our state at the time, based on what's happening in our family, what dates do we think is going to work best? And then we put that out there.
Even then, even if we don't publish that immediately, we might workshop it with one or two players just to go, hey, do you know of anything that's happening that weekend? You know, you can speak to a couple of the local game store managers or...
Yeah, and things like, because we don't know about, we don't play Magic.
The pre-release anymore is a great example.
So, you know, making sure that we're not booking something on a Magic pre-release weekend. And so we do check that out with other people, but that's not the same as throwing it open to a Facebook poll.
No, it's very rare that we've done the Facebook poll thing. And generally
although you did for an event, but anyway, let's move on from that.
I haven't announced anything from that. I just wanted to get the information because that was a big event and we need to make sure that works. The whole, once you make a decision as a TO, you kind of have to stick with it. As soon as you announce it, unless something drastic happens where you have to make a change, as soon as you start making changes based on public feedback from what you've done, it's a very slippery slope where you just end up in limbo, either making constant changes or upsetting people where you make changes for one person for something that they wanted, but you don't make changes for someone else that you think you can't do. And so it's just not a good place to be.
So I talk about transparency a lot. And with that, if anybody asks, why have you made this decision? We're more than happy to discuss the reasoning that went behind a decision that we've made. And if somebody comes up with something that is truly significant that makes us think that we've made the wrong decision, then we'll discuss it and we then make a decision as to whether or not to change our decision. But really, it's about keeping people informed around the decision-making process rather than having 500 people involved in that decision-making process.
Yeah, decision by committee never really works because you've got too many fingers in the pie.
Yeah, and nothing gets done because you're too busy talking about what could get done.
Yeah.
Different options.
One of the advantages of what we do over potentially some of the clubs is that there's just the two of us. We argue by ourselves and then we...
One overrules the other and then we go for it.
Yeah, exactly. There's no other people included in that conversation.
Yeah.
So let's assume you found a date and you're happy.
How long have we been talking now? We've only got to the date.
20 minutes.
Beautiful.
This is going to be multiple parts. I can see that now.
Yeah.
The next step is venue. Mm-hmm. And like I said, you know, you might be fortunate and have a venue that you have readily available to you, whether that's your local gaming store, whether that's a public space that you can access, like at a public hall or a town hall or something like that.
I'm just going to backtrack a little bit, if that's okay. So one of the questions that came up when we were doing the live on Wednesday was around how much does an event cost? And
that's a how long is a piece of string question.
It really is. And you can run an event for as little or as much as you want.
Was willing to gamble.
Yeah. But it's about, before you even start, you need to kind of set an expectation of the kind of event that you're wanting to run. So an event that happens in, you know, the back room of a store that can only hold a maximum of, say, 16 players is going to be very different to an event that's run in someone's back garden that can only hold 8 players, or an event that's run in South Perth Community Centre that can hold 120 players.
Yeah, all the way up to LVO when you're in the 500.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So it's around kind of setting an idea of the kind of event that you're hoping to run and what sort of what expectations do you have for your own event?
Yeah.
And once you know that, that then impacts the kind of venue that you start looking for.
Yeah, absolutely. Because like you've just hinted at there, the your local gaming store might be awesome and all of the guys all congregate and they buy their stuff from there every week, mm-hmm. but they've only got 4 4x4 gaming tables.
And if you're hoping to run, you know, a 2,000-point event, yeah, you're going to really struggle on 4x4 yeah. boards.
So certainly the venue, I mean, we budget about 12 square metres per table.
Well, that depends. We'd like to have 12 square metres, but when we have 120 players in the room, it's a bit less
yep.
than 12 square metres.
So
we aim to not have men's butts touching at any point in the event.
We aim to have no one's butts touching, regardless of gender.
Regardless of gender, that is true, yes.
I don't know whether it's better or worse the other ways, but no, so when you actually start talking about the space required, the venue does play a part in that because, like I've just said, it's about 3 meters by 4 meters is what you want, which is roughly 9.5 feet by about 13 feet. Mm. That takes into account, obviously, putting a 6x4 table in the middle and then enough space for the average-sized adult to kind of move around the table.
We do aim for slightly larger than average size adult.
Well, we certainly try and accommodate all shapes and sizes. Mm. And again, the venues, sometimes you have to squeeze things a little bit too yeah. close and everyone gets a bit cozy.
Yeah.
You certainly don't want
to... warm and you pray for air conditioning.
Yep. Sometimes we've had to butt tables up and obviously your square meterage per table reduces at that point because you're losing that gap between the tables.
We aim to have no more than 2 tables butted up though.
Yep. If we can help it.
Yeah. I don't think we've ever run an event with 3, though.
No, but WATC, when we had 120 players in that room, was very cozy because we had 60
cozy.
Tables.
Yeah, but we did still only have 2. And the reason that we have 2 is because that way you can still move around your table without impacting any other
yeah.
player in the room.
The second you get 3 or 4 or 5 in a row, I understand the practicalities of having to do that. Like
yeah.
At big events like LVO where you've got 3 or 4, I think it was 4s that we had when we were in at LVO. You've got no choice.
No.
Just sheer numbers and space will inevitably lead to that situation. But at the same time, our goal is always to kind of keep it in pairs if possible,
mm-hmm.
As a worst case
or
scenario.
Singles.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you're allowing for that sort of, call it 10 to 15 square meters a table, depending on how much room you want to give and whether you're butting tables up and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
If you say to yourself, cool, I want to play a 40 player event. So that's 20 tables. So now I need a space that is at least 200 square meters.
Mm-hmm.
Realistically, we want more than 200 square meters. We want more like 300 square meters.
Well, so it's not only... this was something else that we talked about on the Facebook Live, that it's not only your 20 tables that you need in that room.
No.
So we also have to make sure at all times that we have 2 meters between the emergency
exits. Yeah,
the
fire exits, yep.
And, you know, with not a corridor, but you know what I mean, like creating that 2 meter gap down the edges of the room so people can actually get out of the room should the need arise. We make sure that we have room for our TO table, which...
Any prize tables and that sort of stuff that we need as well.
So all of that kind of stuff takes up additional space as well.
I think that, like, talking very quickly about the whole evacuation thing, I think a lot of players listening to this right now will be laughing, going, "Yeah, right, like evacuation, like." But no, it's actually here in Australia, at least, it's a very serious thing where you have to make sure that you have emergency exits clear and make sure that there's easy access to those exits. And you know, at show in particular, we had some very strict guidelines we had to adhere to with the fire wardens to make sure that they had access if need be.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like something really silly to think about, and it's something that anyone who works in occupational health and safety is probably nodding their head going, yep,
yeah,
I get that. But I imagine that most gamers don't ever consider it.
No, well, it was quite interesting because when we started running events at South Perth Community Centre, I asked for a copy of a floor plan and, you know, information around where the emergency evacuation points are and all of that. And, you know, she had it all there, but she was like, yeah, we don't often get asked for
this.
So it was interesting. But no, it is something that we do take really seriously, knowing that we do have quite a few people coming. And while, touch wood, we've never had a need to evacuate the building, we need to make sure that if the need arises, we can get everyone out safely.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, so those...
people's safety is always our first concern as well.
Yeah, it has to be.
But that does come down to, I guess, some of the equipment that we use and those kinds of things, which are the things that we think about.
Yeah. So you've got to find yourself a venue that's free on the date, that's going to accommodate...
By free, he means available.
Yep.
If you can find one that's free...
Absolutely.
...cost-wise, you go for that. We haven't found one yet.
No. And that's the third part of the venue that you've got to kind of consider is... the venue itself, does it have ample parking? Is it free parking?
Parking's a really big one. So that's something that we have struggled with when we've been looking at different venues, trying to find a... because generally, all of our attendees drive.
Yep. You get the odd one, public transport. But
90% of them come by themselves. You get the odd one where they will carpool and, you know, a mate will pick somebody up. But generally, or, you know... husband and wife come together, that's always good.
You get a couple of the teams who go for breakfast and there's four of them in a car, but it's few and far between.
No, I think they all meet at the car park and get into one car. But still, so, you know...
so they can sulk in private on their way home when they don't win.
So we need to make sure that we've got parking for, at times, well, at least 120 for the attendees. But then we do also have general public that come and walk around and check out the events.
Not to mention our car and trailers and... and then any catering that we've got coming.
Yeah.
Like for WATC, we had 120 players and we filled the top car park and most of the bottom car park at that particular venue.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's something that, again, most players I suspect wouldn't consider as how much space you've actually got to get people to the venue.
Yeah.
And obviously that's going to change if you've got different public transport options than we have here in Perth. Mm-hmm. But it's certainly a factor in... our decision-making process to make sure that people can actually park their cars. And
then, as you said before, the cost of parking.
Mm.
So, you know, we charge between $35 and $40 for an event ticket. If you're having to pay $50 or $60 for a day for parking...
yeah, that's just a deal breaker at that point.
Yeah.
I mean, we got offered a venue in quite a nice part of Western Australia and... the price was pretty good and it was a lovely place to be. And then the parking was $4 an hour.
But you could only park for 3 hours.
Yeah, which is just instantly a deal breaker because you just can't, you can't have players playing a game and then everyone rushing outside to buy more tickets and musical chairs and, or musical cars, I should say. It was just an untenable resolution. So, you know, people were going, oh, just pay for an all-day pass at the multi-story car park. Well, you're now talking $25 a day.
If there is a multi-car park, multi-story
car park.
Well,
this particular venue
around.
Did have one around the corner. But
did
if
it?
Yeah, but if... but given...
I'm so useless with things like
you
that.
Are. But this for this particular venue, we were talking about show. Now, we filled 1.5 of the car parks at the previous venue. We had 500 or 600 cars at any given time in that park that we would have filled the multi-story and then some.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, we're back to the same problem. So, certainly the scale of the event will dictate that parking scenario, particularly if, like I say, you don't have great public transport.
Yeah, but, you know, if you're running an 8-player event in your back garden, chances are you can probably fit 8 cars on your road.
Yeah, somewhere nearby.
You know, running it in a workshop somewhere in an industrial area... generally, you can manage to find a parking space.
Yeah, and I mean, as people use Uber and taxis and that sort of thing, then obviously that decreases. And I know a few people who do use Uber to get around for that sort of thing. But
here in WA?
Yeah. But, yeah, so the venue isn't as simple as just finding a space. While we're talking about the venue as well, you also need to consider what materials and what... resources you have available at the venue. So things
tables
like...
tables and chairs.
Yeah, trestle tables, chairs, whether there's a PA system, what sort of AV equipment they might have available to you. Does
it whether
have
it works.
Yep. Does it have a kitchen facility at all? Because that'll...
toilets.
Yep. There's a whole... Wi-Fi, free Wi-Fi. There's a whole bunch of those sorts of things that have to factor into your decision-making process. If you're using something like Best Coast Pairings or Down Under Pairings where you're going paperless... then obviously the best situation is for there to be Wi-Fi available so that players can use their electronic devices to do the scoring.
Saying that, we do have Wi-Fi available at City of South Perth, and it's just, I never use it because it's absolutely terrible.
Well, that, I'm just wondering whether that's an Australian NBN thing, but...
I don't know, because at Ascot it was fine.
Yeah, that's true.
So, I don't know if they, you know, South Perth have just got the slowest internet that they could possibly buy. I don't know.
But yeah, that's something that we have to think about.
And here's why. So as far as the tables and chairs... So when we were looking at WATC last year, as we said, we had 120 players and we only had access to how many trestles?
The venue on paper has 40.
So
in reality, I think it's 37 because of the damaged ones.
Found, well, yeah, no, for Masters, I think we found out that a few more of them were damaged. So if you say 35, so we've now got tables for 70 players.
60.
35 times 2.
What do you need times 2? Oh, you mean what's at the venue? Yeah. I got you. I'm with you. It's all good.
So we're short, you know, tables for 50 players. We're short 25 tables. Now, we attempted to try and hire trestle tables because that was going to be the easiest option for us. They were $15 to hire per trestle.
But the delivery was what killed it.
Delivery fee, because we needed them delivering at 6 o'clock on a Saturday morning and picking up 6 o'clock on a Saturday evening, was going to cost us $400 delivery and $460 for pickup, plus additional time for, and we had to pay like an extra surcharge for drivers or something like that.
Because it was same day.
Yes. And because it was weekend and because it was out of hours and all of those things. So all of a sudden we go from paying $15 for 25 trestle tables to...
$15 per trestle table.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
To this astronomical amount. And you're just like, that's just completely untenable.
Yeah.
So I bought a whole heap of trestle tables.
And then you have to try and figure out how to get them there.
Then we had to get them there.
Yeah.
So we bought a trailer for OBSEC, which when we run events, we fill.
And then some these days.
That's it. So that trailer is full with...
Mostly boards and terrain.
35 boxes of terrain, tables for 30, you know, 35
We actually boards. Can't get it all in there now. We've grown to a point where the SUV we've got and the trailer don't actually carry everything either.
No. So that was great. How are we going to get 25 trestle tables to the event as well? So it became quite difficult in that we had to then ask other players to...
Yeah, we have to say thank you to Courtney from the Toy Soldier Cartel for pitching in for that particular...
And Jason
from the Tabletop Mafia.
Yeah. So these are all the logistics that go on behind the scenes for going, well, yes, we've got enough space to fit 120, but we didn't have the resources. And when we got the resources, how are we going to transport those resources?
Yeah.
So, I mean, we did also look at whether or not we could hire a truck and how much was it going to cost to hire a truck to get everything there and, you know, all of those kinds. And for show, we obviously do hire a truck.
We made the mistake the first year of doing it ourselves. The second year, we had a removalist. And that was so much easier. He's coming back for 2019.
Like that was a complete brainwave as I was planning on hiring the truck. And I was like, oh, my goodness. Wonder how much a removalist is.
Five phone
calls
later.
That comes with a man.
Yep. Five phone calls later, I had someone and it turned out he was a gamer.
And he was awesome. But so all of those things go into the venue as well.
Yeah, absolutely. The venue seems like something easy.
It's really not.
It's
not. Can I just very quickly also touch on toilets? Toilets are really important.
Yes.
Also really important is who's going to clean those toilets? Because that's never me, ever. I am not cleaning toilets after 115 men and 5 women.
No, that's true. I mean, we're fortunate that the venue we typically use is a council-managed premises where they have cleaners that come in every day.
That we pay for.
That are part of the hire fee.
Yep.
And the toilet facilities that we have at that particular venue are fairly new. Hmm. They're well-maintained. There's... Hmm. Enough room there for plenty of people.
Although I did get caught out for Masters last year when I was gloating about... So women are always the ones who have to queue for the toilets. And I was gloating going, we've got however many men here and I'm the only woman. I've got 7 toilets all to myself. Went in, one broke down. Didn't break, you know, stopped working, whatever it was, out of service. But I think it's really important to know that if you are going to have however many people in the same venue, one toilet is not going to cut it.
Yeah, I did an ATC where we had six teams of eight. So was that 48 players?
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't seem particularly massive.
Plus there were a few
spectators and hangers on. So, you know,
maybe up to 60.
Somewhere between 50 and 60 people in the venue at any given time. It was a two-day event. And there was one cubicle,
mm-hmm.
and by the end of day one, the toilet wasn't working.
Can I just say, for anyone who's thinking inclusive events, a unisex toilet is not going to cut it. Toilet on day two, after all of those men have been out drinking the night before. You know.
Fair enough.
So, I do want my own.
But yeah, that... that didn't work particularly well for day two for that particular event. It was not a pleasant place to be. So, or was it? No, it was the urinal that broke down at the end of day one. So there was literally...
How's the urinal break down?
I don't know. There was no water or something for it. But yeah, it was.
Ugh.
Yeah, it was pretty bad. Can laugh about it now. Look, and as stupid as it sounds, access to that toilet, because at LVO, there are no toilets in the Bally's casino where you actually are playing. You have to leave the convention hall, go back out through the sort of the sales floor area where Forge World and Hammerhead Games and all those guys are, and then go back out past security into the main sort of hallway that leads you down to the function area to get to the toilets.
Mm.
So if you're playing at the tournament,
that's a 15-minute round trip.
Yeah, and if it's busy, then you can lose 20 minutes doing that process. So you've got to think about, as the numbers...
When you time that.
Yeah, well, yeah. As the numbers go up, can you imagine what happens when LVO's got 540K players plus a couple hundred AOS players plus War Machine and Bolt Action and X-Wing and all these tournaments, and if any two of them or more finish at roughly the same time, you then get 700-800 people all nicking to the nearest bathroom... You end up with massive queues.
It's faster to go to your room.
Almost. So, yeah, it seems like something really weird to think about, but it's something that you do actually have to think about. If someone has to nick off in the middle of a game, how much time is being lost?
And so I spoke on the Facebook Live about the fact that we had been trying to look at whether or not us sourcing a permanent venue was achievable. And it's certainly something that we're looking at. You know, a lot of the places that we have been looking, they come with one toilet. And we're just going, well, how much is it going to cost for us to get this increase to having at least
one other
six toilets, really? So, because, yeah, if you're looking at having 100 people in there, one or two toilets just doesn't cut it.
No.
Plus also, one of the other things that we do always try and think about for events is disabled access.
Yep. We're fortunate with show for the last couple of years. We've had an elevator that's let us move people. We have had, the first year we had, was it two people in wheelchairs or was it only one?
I don't know.
I know we had at least one. It might have been two.
There were a few people that needed to use it
for different
mobility
different
reasons.
Things, yeah. So, yeah, obviously our standard tournament venue has ramps and access and the
disabled toilets.
Yep. So that is stuff that it sounds silly to think about, but
it's not silly to think about.
It's definitely something that we plan around.
And... Actually, for Masters last year, I did have someone, I don't know whether or not I told you this, I did have someone who sent me a message and said, I do have a disability. Would it be okay if I still come along to the event? And, you know, I was like, well, can you pick up a dice and roll it? You know, it's for us, that's not in any way, shape or form something that we would ever consider saying, well, no, you can't come because you've got a disability.
No, absolutely not.
What I did check out with him was what kind of space do you require? Do you have a wheelchair? Do you require any extra space? Are there any additional requirements that you may have, any way that I can make this event easier for you to actually be able to attend? And he was like, no, I just, I might be a bit slower walking and things like that. Is that going to be an issue? I was like, you're standing at a table all day, buddy. You should be fine. And although that's sort of coming out a little bit flippant, really we try and be as inclusive as possible for everyone, which does mean thinking about disabled access, but it does also mean thinking about things like, what are the toilets like for women who are coming along? Because that really is gross sometimes.
So, we've covered the date. We've covered the venue.
Covered the toilets.
Which apparently is a very, very passion point for you.
It really is. I didn't realise how much it was till I started talking.
They're kind of the most of the core things. The last thing, which is kind
most of the core things. Oh my god, they're not even close,
no.
But
I'm starting, like, I'm trying to step through it the way we would normally do it. Yeah. So, the last part of the resources that you have to consider before you sort of get too much further in is actually
tables and terrain.
So, assuming that the venue you have has trestle tables for you to use, or you can hire them, or you can buy them, or you can
get friends or people who can bring them.
You still need to put tabletops on those because inevitably they're not going to be 6 feet by 4 feet.
Nope.
And you still need to then...
And you cannot push two trestle tables together and roll them out.
No, you can't do that. There's a big divot in the middle and it just doesn't work. It might do in a pinch if you're one table short, but I certainly wouldn't recommend it. With a thick enough neoprene, you might get away with it, but it actually gets really awkward to get to the table because the space is just too wide.
That is something I know that we've... Sorry, I've kind of gone off on a tangent. But we did have people asking, could we have two trestle tables pushed together so that we had more space?
Mm.
But really, no, because it does make it quite tricky for you to reach over the table to get to the other side. And
look, it's just another resource that A, we may not have multiples not spare of, and B, takes up more room, which means that there's less available gaming area.
For some of our smaller of events, like when we ran the 30K events that...
Yeah, we've had spare tables to put army setups on and, put casualty boxes and, spare space. So you've got to decide how you're putting the boards out on the tables. Just looking at the boards themselves, if you're going to try and transport 6-foot by 4-foot pieces of MDF or pine or whatever,
2x4s.
Don't do that. Go 2x4s. 2x4s by far and away is, in my opinion, and I
Emerico's,
the best way to get your tables anywhere because you can generally, if you're only carrying a few of them, you can put them in the back seat of your car. If you can fold your seats down in your car, they'll often fit through the boot into the back seat.
They're much more manageable for me to actually lift and carry.
I was about to say, carrying them and manoeuvring them through doorways is easier. Yeah. Going to 3x4 panels is just awkward and bulky, and you can't necessarily get them into every car, and they fit weirdly in trailers. The 2x4s are definitely my preference in setting up tables. So if you are looking at investing in just your home table setup and you want something...
I've written a blog post on that.
Grab a 2x4, grab a 6x4 and get it cut into 2x4 sections. Yep. Here in Australia, there's a sheet. It's 2440 by 1220, which is essentially 8 feet by 4 feet that you can get from our local hardware store Bunnings for about $25.
And
they'll cut it for you.
Particularly if one of the men who cuts the boards happens to come along to events, that's always useful.
Ben was very good for us for that work. That was actually for WATC. We must have come down and made him cut, I don't know how many dozen boards up.
After completely panicking because that was the third Bunnings we'd gone to and none of them had the board that we would normally get, and we'd left it till the day before.
Because we thought, no, this is a standard product. Everyone will have it.
Yeah, we'll leave that. We know how to do that.
That was a mistake.
That's the easiest bit. Oh, my God.
So
that'd be another thing. Plan ahead. Don't leave things till the day before.
Boards, getting them in 2x4 panels makes it a much easier option to move them around. It's easier to get people to help you to move them around if you need to.
MDF is lighter than chipboard.
Yep.
We use, is it 6mm?
6mm is our standard board, but I actually think it's probably a bit too thin. I'd much rather an 8 or a 9mm board, but then you start actually getting quite heavy.
I like the 6mm because it's much lighter and I can lift it easier.
Generally speaking, once you put a mat or something over the top of it it's fine.
Yeah.
We've got a couple of them that are 12mm, and I've even got one out there that's 15mm.
Yes.
Which is super stable, but it's never going to a tournament. It's just too heavy and too bulky.
Yeah.
The second part of that equation, like I've already mentioned, is the surface of the boards. Back when when we first started running tournaments, and obviously prior to that, when we opened the Gaming Club Outpost 6030 South, we basically bought a bunch of chipboard. Got them cut to 3x4s. Why we picked 3x4s, I'll never know.
It made sense at the time.
And painted them green. We bought a 4-litre can of... we took
grotty green.
Well, it was goblin green was the colour back in the day that we took in and they colour matched for us.
I don't don't think it was. I reckon we got the standard fence paint. Because I'm fairly sure I was working at WA Salvage at the time. And I think you came in and got it from me at the paint section.
Could very well have been.
And it was just the standard
green. It was a fairly bright timber green kind of colour. It was horrible.
Yeah. And then, because we were really fancy, we got paintbrushes and sort of like splattered. Add a mottled effect with the darker green.
Yeah, oh, look, there was some paint rollers and I remember lining them up on my parents' driveway and just walking up and down them with paint rollers to try and get the coverage on them in the Australian summer. So that is enough in a pinch, but I think the average gamer, particularly if they've been exposed to some of the bigger events around the world...
The expectations
are a little bit higher. So there's a few different ways you can put surfaces on the board to make it nicer to play on. Obviously, the neoprene mats are the high end of that spectrum, but they can be exceptionally expensive.
And it's something else to have to transport.
It is. Believe it or not, it's a really painful thing because we've got, I think it's 12 or 14 of those 14 neoprene plus, mats.
No, we've got 15. We've got 14 in the zippy bags and one in the hard case.
Yeah. And they're bloody heavy when you start lugging 10 or 15 of them around.
15 on them on your back, yeah.
And... they're another thing you have to make space for.
And remember.
Yes.
You're not very good at that.
No, there's something that's often the morning of, I'm getting ready to leave and gone, oh, forgot the mats, go back inside, spend 10 minutes.
Or he's left 5 minutes before me and then we'll ring and go, ah, I've forgotten the mats again. I'll turn around and go and get them.
So, how are you going to surface them? Whether it's paint, whether it's self-adhesive.
The secured Battlescape.
Yep, the self-adhesive vinyls.
Yep.
Or whether it's something else like a neoprene, there are plenty of options there. Mm-hmm. Your third thing to consider is the actual terrain.
Mm.
And terrain is a contentious issue for any game system, unless you're talking maybe X-Wing, which doesn't really have terrain.
Mm-hmm.
And the game system will obviously change what you need for... And we're talking 6x4s because we are talking Games Workshop's two flagship Blood games.
Pretty okay for terrain as well.
Yep.
They're my two favourite systems.
War Machine's only on a 4x4.
Yeah, I do look quite like War Machine as well.
Malifaux's 3x3, but it's more dense terrain.
No, dense terrain, no.
Although 3.0 might have changed that. I haven't looked at the beta rules yet.
Yeah, no, my favourite is the X-Wing because we have to do nothing.
And Blood Bowl.
Blood Bowl, the players bring their own stuff as well. Brilliant. And then...
everything else.
No. Then War Machine, Hordes. I love that. They need nothing. And it's so easy to make.
Well, they're very big on 2D terrain.
Mm. Nah, some of them are. Some of them aren't so much.
But you have to consider, A, where is this terrain coming from?
Mm.
B, what standard are you going to set for that terrain?
Mm-hmm. And try and make that consistent across all of your tables.
Yep. C, how is it getting there? And how is it getting back to wherever it belongs?
Mm-hmm.
And finally, are you buying it? Are you building and painting it yourself? Is it, there's all those other situations. And then how are you storing it? What is it being stored in? It's quite a complex situation to be in. We started with, I think it was 7 or 8 tables that we put together for our first event. And we borrowed a shitload from people and from Alpo 6030.
Yeah.
So we did the first Masters event. We had like 66 players and I think 7 of the tables were ours, 8 of the tables were ours and everything else was borrowed because at that stage...
I think 11 might have been ours. I know it wasn't even close to half. No.
But, and then as we've done more and more events, we've endeavoured to re-inject any remaining money
into more terrain.
We're very fortunate that things like OTP Terrain is now around so that they're doing some really cool inventive terrain, which we're going to be seeing on our tables in 2019 as soon as they get around to placing that order.
Mm, get on to that.
And
someone's got to build it, paint it and...
You're going to have fun with that. I know you are.
Oh, my God.
So the terrain is definitely something you need to consider for the game system. Make sure it's appropriate for the game system. And like I say, if you're going to say... And we've set a standard that we say, no, we want painted miniatures.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, the players have, in my mind at least, the right to expect painted terrain and to a certain standard. Now, our terrain, we spend a lot of time across the year repairing and repainting where necessary and looking after it as best we can. When we do have to borrow terrain for some of the bigger events, obviously we lose a bit of that control. which is, you know, part and parcel of the process when we do get volunteers to help out, or whether the clubs pitch in and they have some new terrain that isn't quite ready yet. But certainly the standard that you're trying to set for the event is something that you would want to mirror in your own setup. So you...
Not quite. I think you have to be really aware that when you're creating terrain for events, things like the, you know, the little turrets that go on the top of the building.
Oh, practicality, absolutely.
Yeah. And knowing that this terrain is going to get damaged.
Yeah, it's
going to
get beaten
important.
Around.
So I wouldn't necessarily put as much energy into the fine detail as you would if it was just your one...
For home, yeah.
Yeah, I'm, you know, schmick board that's absolutely perfect.
But what I mean is, if you're expecting your players to have base colours on your miniatures, then...
Oh, look, most definitely.
Your terrain, in theory, should meet that standard.
I actually think that when you're going for a job interview, I always think that you should wear one, you know, kind of like one step up to your interview than what you would wear for your everyday job. And I think it's the same for events and terrain. I think that our terrain should have to be at least a level higher than what we expect of attendees.
I think you need to go back and do some more work on some of it then.
We don't have anything that's base colours only.
No, there's not. They've all been washed and dry brushed and
had windows
battle damaged and windows filled in. And
dirts. Well,
grime
yeah.
and all sorts put on them. So none of them are going to win Golden Demon.
No,
but as an interesting
that's
surface.
The same thing.
No.
Like, but I'm saying that what we expect is that, you know, for base colours only for models, we don't just do base colours only for
our terrain.
No, we
do weathering, or we do shading, and we do other bits and pieces.
Dry brushing and, you know, basing. Everything's kind of based with some kind of texture or flock or something.
Yeah. So the terrain, like I say, should be appropriate for the game system that you're playing in the right sort of volumes and ratios. And then, like I say, how you're getting it there and back, how it's being stored, where it's coming from. I'm not a huge fan of sort of crowdsourcing terrain, if at all possible. It's very different to getting a club to commit to letting you, because we never expect the clubs to bring it for us. We always go and pick it up. You know, reaching out to the clubs and saying, hey, we want to borrow 20 tubs of your terrain for show or whatever it happens to be. We go and pick it up. We make sure it gets returned in the same sort of condition that we picked it up in. And we know we're picking it up from two clubs. And then we were fortunate for 2018. We had, I think it was eight tables from Beyond Games and Hobby that they came up from Bunbury with as well.
Yep.
And that was kind of the extent of the terrain resources that we had. It meant that we weren't relying on 50 people bringing a board each, which is obviously a significant risk the bigger the event gets.
Yeah, and the reason... There's a couple of reasons that we prefer not to have attendees bring their terrain. The first is that if we are bringing the terrain, as much as I joke and say that you forget things and don't necessarily focus on the detail, we know that we have 35 boxes of terrain here. So we know that 35 boxes of terrain are coming to the event. We know that... Yeah. You know, 35 boards are coming to the event, plus 15 additional mats. All of our boards have got the vinyl battlescapes on them. You know, so we can be assured that all of that is actually going to turn up.
Yeah.
And if somebody says, oh, no, that's cool, I've got four at home, I can bring them, and then that player's late or that player for some reason can't attend and you've been relying on that, then...
Yeah, there's issues.
Yeah.
And look, I mean, we had it happen at Masters where we were one board short, which was frustrating as anything because we had double checked it and triple checked it. And
not only that, we took extra boards.
Yeah. And we were one short. So we were fortunate that one of the helpers had turned up. He went, hey, look, I live 15 minutes away. I'll nick home and grab my board if you can bring it back for me.
Yeah.
So we did that. And, you know, we got our last table that we needed.
Thank goodness.
But that
we would have been butting two tables up and rolling a neoprene out.
But that was an added stress for the day we didn't need.
No, most definitely.
So how are you getting your terrain to where it needs to be, and when it's getting there and when it's going home and how it's going home is all other logistical issues you have to consider. again, if you're at a local gaming store and they've got their boards and tables set up permanently, obviously that's stuff that you might not have to think about unless they don't regularly host the game system that you're wanting to run the tournament for. Mm. If they've only got 40k terrain and you're wanting to run a War Machine event, that's probably going to be awkward because a lot of the terrain doesn't really cross over particularly well between game systems. And by the same token, Malifaux and Age of Sigmar, while there's a little bit of crossover, the density is a massive change. Mm. So you do have to be mindful of those sorts of things as well. But since we've been going an hour now, and we haven't even gotten close to the end of this, we've literally talked about the where, the when, and a little bit of the how, and we've still got plenty more to cover. We might have to turn this into a two-part episode and wrap up this topic and come back in a future episode to cover more of Life of a TO. So we'll be back in just a second to wrap up this episode. Well, now that that topic's not even close to being covered, we're still ending the episode. But we've got to talk about the important things, my Titan.
Very quickly, because this is already going to be a really long episode, so we're going to try and be restrained.
No, we're not.
One of us is going to try and be restrained.
So the Warlord is now... Emma's giggling in the background here. So the Warlord is now at a state where I can hit it with Undercoat. Unfortunately for me, it's been really hot the last few days. And
it's going to be over 38 for the whole week.
Yeah, I've got to find a day where it's a bit cooler. I've also realised today I don't actually have a spray booth big enough for it. Not even a cardboard box I can put it in. So not so much the torso, the legs is my thing to stop any overspray and mess happening. So I've got to...
I have to see if we can get like a moving box.
Yeah, I'm sure we can find a cardboard box somewhere around here. But I've been using a product which I have to give a shout out to, which is Tamiya Putty White. I'm sure a bunch of our long-term hobbyists or American listeners in particular, because Tamiya is a big brand over there, will probably be familiar with it. But if you're not,
Tamiya's a big...
It's a big model company.
Yeah, that's it. But I was going to say it's really well known in the, I guess, the modeling thing, like for model cars and model planes and trains and that kind of thing.
This stuff, I wasn't sold on it when I first started to use it, but after about 4 hours of messing about with it and the Titan, I really like it. It probably deserves its own video to kind of explain the best ways to use it, but it's comes in a tube. It's a lot like a toothpaste-style consistency, and it basically I've been treating it like grout for tiles, and it's worked surprisingly well. I'm actually really impressed with the finish on it. There's a little bit of shrinkage in it, but it's not insurmountable with a couple of coats.
That's why it reminds me of the fine plaster.
Yeah.
That you get the same kind of shrinkage with the plaster as well. So.
But yeah, I finished the last of the fill today, so it's ready for undercoat at some point when the temperature drops below 30 degrees.
It might be at least another week.
Well, I thought I saw a day later this week that was going to drop into the 20s, so hopefully.
Not when I looked at it this morning, but hope so for your sake.
Yeah, because I'm keen to get some paint on it. I've got the airbrush out and set up, and I went and bought some new paints. So we're... closing on the painting stage, which is great. If you're interested in keeping up with the live updates, you can visit our Patreon page, patreon.com/objectivesecured. I post a whole bunch of stuff to that, and we've got our podcast, the patrons only one that comes out every month.
Which we need to be getting onto.
Yes, because that's a few days away.
Yes.
So, yeah, the Titans, it's getting there. I've been researching how to do the colours for it. I went and bought a whole bunch from Hobbytech, which is in Myrie here in Western Australia, which is my go-to now for anything basically not Games Workshop. They supplied all the brass and all the paint and the putties and all the other bits and pieces for it, which is great. So, yeah, it's...
Not the glue, mind you.
No, that came from Bunnings because the epoxy that came from Bunnings was way cheaper.
Yeah.
And... industrial grade rather than hobby grade. So, yeah, I'm really looking forward to getting some paint on it. It's it feels like I'm now sort of halfway through the process, and I can actually start working on some of the finer points and things like the pilots, the moderati, and the precepts, which will have to be painted separately anyway. without the airbrush. It means that I can do those with a brush in the night when it's a bit quieter and a bit cooler without having to worry too much about the airbrush, because obviously the humidity and the temperature plays a bit of havoc with it.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm looking forward to getting some paint on that and then getting this Titan finished, and then, yeah, looking at some of the other projects for the rest of the year, which is basically more Titans, more toys to build, get some of the big stuff done.
Buying anything new?
I
think that pretty much covers the Titan, so we'll move on. So we have spoken with Chris,
yep,
who was one of the 40K organisers for CanCon. He was on a couple of months ago speaking about CanCon.
Yeah, and he's going to come back and join us for a follow-up episode.
Yeah, so we're thinking that we'll do that next fortnight, which means the end of this discussion will happen in a month. So if you've made it to this point of the episode, let us know if anything's come up that you've got questions about, and we can see whether or not we can speak about those questions, or whether you kind of go, you know what, I reckon we've got it covered, we don't need anything more.
And we can move on to the second part of that conversation, yeah, around some of the, you know, the other bits and pieces that go into an event. And
Or if there's particular parts of events that you want us to cover, just let us know what they are.
Yeah, definitely, because, we provide the content out there for you guys to listen to, and if it's stuff you want us to talk about, then we'll talk about it.
Yep.
I think that covers it for today, though. Oh, you're going to be on a podcast, another podcast shortly.
Yes,
which
that's
is
right.
yet to be named, so mm-hmm. we'll have more details of that for the next episode, so that we can make sure you guys head over and listen to Emma talking about some other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily gaming related, but I'm sure there'll be hints at it.
It is gaming related. So that's with Mike and Pierce.
Yes.
And that's being recorded Saturday morning, but I'm not sure when that's actually going out.
No, I think they're going to try and get a few episodes sort of stacked up
their sleeve,
so they can publish them. Mm-hmm. And sort of get ahead, which is what we've tried to do. And we did do before the holiday, and then we're back to recording them sort of every fortnight.
Mm-hmm. I'm quite pleased. It's Monday when we're recording this, and this doesn't go out till Wednesday,
yeah,
so that's pretty good.
Because
last
means
episode was, we recorded it Wednesday afternoon.
And then
to
I edit
go
it
out
and publish it Wednesday night.
Night.
Yeah. This is actually going to give me the chance to edit it properly tomorrow and get it all together.
Yeah, we've still got the patrons only one that we've got to record.
Yes.
Which, does that go out Thursday?
Thursday? What's today? The 28th, 29th, 30th, 31st. I've got four Friday, I think it is. So we'll have to record that one at some point in the next couple of days.
Thursday might be a good day to record that.
If there's any guests you'd like us to get on our podcast, we're more than happy to try and get those people on. Send us a message on Facebook or on Twitter or on the website.
Probably don't do Twitter. Do you check Twitter?
Yeah, I check Twitter.
Oh, do you? Okay, yeah. Fine. Message Twitter then. I should definitely do that. Because
that way she doesn't have to deal
that's
with it.
I don't read that.
So we might wrap it up for today.
Mm-hmm.
If you haven't listened to our live stream on Wednesday nights, we're there every second Wednesday alternating with this podcast release.
Mm-hmm.
So come and say hello to us live on Wednesday nights.
Mm-hmm.
And we will catch you in 2 weeks for the next episode. So, thanks for listening.
Happy gaming, everyone.
You've been listening to the Objective Secured podcast. If you'd like to get in touch, you can visit our website, objectivesecured.com.au. You can find us on Facebook.com/objectivesecured, or you can email us obsec@optusnet.com.au. Thanks for listening.